Russian general is dead, killed in an explosion in Moscow. Ukraine is apparently claiming responsibility.
This is, in a way, retribution or justice that Ukrainians have served to this person who, by all accounts, is a war criminal.
I'm Marco Werman. More on that brazen attack in Russia's capital. Also, a mass grave in Syria said to hold the remains of at least 100,000 people.
So many families, including my own, like my uncle, could be in that mass grave. My friends could be in that mass grave.
Plus, 10 years on, what happened with the thaw between the U.S. and Cuba, and the two biggest economies in Europe now share something new.
It's the first time there will be a day train between our two capitals.
Bratwurst, meat baguette, all that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. My co-host Carolyn Beeler is out this week. We begin today in Moscow, where an early morning explosion on a residential street killed a Russian general and his assistant. According to authorities there, the target of the attack was Igor Kirillov. He was the head of the Russian military's nuclear, biological, and chemical protection forces, and notorious among Ukrainians for his role in chemical weapon attacks in Ukraine. Ukraine's security service claimed responsibility for the assassination, calling Kirillov a legitimate military target. The World's Daniel Hoffman has more.
The news of General Igor Kirillov's death was the top story today across Russian media.
Сегодня в Москве в результате взрыва погиб начальник войск радиационной, химической и биологической защиты генерал-лейтенант Игорь Кириллов.
Russian media reported that a bomb was strapped onto a scooter and detonated as Kirillov and his assistant exited an apartment building in a residential area of Moscow early this morning. Video footage of the aftermath shows broken glass and other damage in the vicinity of the blast. Svetlana Petrenko, a spokesperson with Russia's investigative committee, came out with a statement earlier today.
Произошедшее квалифицировано как теракт, убийство, незаконный оборот оружия и боеприпасов.
Петренко said what happened is being investigated as a terrorist attack and a murder. Multiple media organizations are reporting that officials from the SBU, Ukraine's security service, are taking responsibility for this action.
This is, in a way, retribution or justice that Ukrainians have served to this person who, by all accounts, is a war criminal.
That's Mariana Bujarin, a researcher at Harvard's Belfer Center with the project on managing the atom. General Kirillov was under sanctions by multiple countries for his actions in Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Yesterday, Ukraine's security service opened a criminal investigation against Kirillov for directing the use of chemical weapons.
Chemical weapons have been used on the battlefield in Ukraine by the Russians. So clearly he was implicated as the commander of those forces in authorizing their use.
During a press briefing last week, Ukrainian Colonel Artem Vlasyuk said that there have been 4,800 incidents of Russia using chemical weapons in Ukraine.
We know about 2,000 Ukrainian servicemen have been treated for chemical poisoning since the war started.
General Kirillov, however, was known for often appearing on Russian state TV and in official briefings, accusing Ukraine and the United States of perpetrating crimes against Russia. Often these accusations drifted into conspiracy. In June of last year, Kirillov said that Ukraine, with the help of the United States, was planning to use mosquitoes as a form of biological warfare. During another briefing last year, before Russia's military establishment, Kirillov accused Ukraine of using chemical weapons and that the U.S. and Ukraine were planning to use a dirty bomb as a provocation against Russia. Mariana Bujarin says that this kind of rhetoric is meant to create an atmosphere of confusion and unpredictability.
That's fueling this fog of war, this enormous disinformation campaign, right, which any notion of truth and false has been erased.
Bujarin says that since the start of its full-scale invasion, Russia has been threatening Ukraine and its supporters with the use of nuclear weapons.
In strategic terms, that creates a very dangerous situation because this constant use of nuclear threat, it kind of erodes Russian credibility and runs the risk that when Russia actually means it, we will miss it.
Bujarin explains that the nuclear rhetoric and the use of chemical weapons is a way that Russia is trying to deter Ukraine and its partners from fighting back. So far, this strategy has not been working in Moscow's favor. In the case of Kirillov, Ukraine is showing that it can kill high-ranking military targets deep inside Russian territory. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
When anti-government rebels stormed across Syria and toppled the dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad, many Syrians rushed to the prisons. That's because so many families had seen their loved ones locked away by the Assad regime. A lot of families are still not clear about what happened to those who were disappeared. Today, a gruesome discovery outside of Damascus might offer some answers. A mass grave, its alleged size, is extraordinary. The U.S. State Department is saying it will help Syrians get full accountability for what's found there. A warning for listeners that some details in our next conversation about this are disturbing. Muaz Mustafa helped locate this mass grave. He is the executive director of the U.S.-based Syrian Emergency Task Force, and he just returned from Damascus.
So we discovered this site back in 2021. As you know, the Syrian Emergency Task Force have been custodian of something called the Caesar Files, where a military photographer was able to bring out almost 55,000 photos of men, women, children, and elderly that were tortured to death. We never knew where these bodies went, and we never knew where so many others that were disappeared went. In 2021, we met one of the mass grave workers that we dubbed the grave digger. He informed us that from 2012 until 2018, he worked at Al-Qutaifa on a mass grave site of massive proportions. We then also connected to another mass grave worker who was the excavator driver. He also mentioned the same site. When we use Google Earth, like with the computer facing us and the mass grave workers giving us directions of how they went to work, we were able to locate the site on open source Google Earth and then go back in the time on Google Earth and see how we see these trenches being dug. Now that Syria has been freed by its people, we were able to personally go to this location and see it for the first time, not on satellite imagery, but in real life.
How big is it?
So the best way to explain it is the way that they dug these graves, and it'll give you an idea. So first of all, every week from 2012 until 2018, 8 trucks came, each truck filled with at least 100 people, dead people, that were dumped into trenches. Each trench was 3 to 4 meters wide, 6 to 7 meters deep, and 50 to 150, sometimes 200 meters long in parallel lines.
Yeah, 150 meters, that's like 500 feet. So that's pretty long. And you're saying it could even be longer.
Yes. Sometimes it was a little longer. Sometimes it was a little shorter. But what they would do is they would fill this long line, this trench that's a mass grave. Once it's filled up with bodies, they would cover it. Then they would do another parallel line to that. And honestly, anyone, if you look at the geolocation and go to Google Earth and go back in the timestamp starting in 2012 and move forward, you actually see it.
And given the size of this mass grave and over time, how many bodies is it estimated are buried there?
I gave a very low conservative estimate of 100,000 bodies. But think of the numbers. If we're talking about at least 800 bodies a week, from 2012 until 2018, we're looking at over 300,000 people that are in this just one mass grave location in Syria.
How do you know all this with such specificity, given that you've only just recently been kind of scouring the countryside in Syria?
So first of all, the way we know all of this is that we've spoken to all these different individuals who worked on the mass grave, on this specific mass grave: the bulldozer driver who covered the bodies, the excavator driver who dug the trenches, and the funeral office workers that came from the Damascus municipality, whose job was to pull bodies from these massive tractor trailer trucks into these massive trenches. And one of them, the supervisor of that funeral office workers, he used to have a list every day for these trucks. The list said this many bodies came from 215, intelligence branch 215 of the Assad regime. This many bodies came from Saydnaya, et cetera, et cetera, to match with each truck. All of them separately, who worked different jobs, gave us the exact same information. We've actually announced it publicly. And what the Assad regime did when we did make it public, the Assad regime built a wall around the Qutaifa mass grave, and the Russians sent these vehicles that were placed on the roads leading up to it with these jammers that prevented people, you know, if you had a phone or someone trying to send a signal, it kind of jammed that signal. It shows how the regime was so concerned that we had discovered that.
You know, I mean, just at a real fundamental level, I think some people listening to this conversation might wonder, how could a grave of this size even be created in the first place? And I wonder what that tells us about the extent of the Assad regime's atrocities.
Well, I wonder what that tells us about the world. You know, the fact is, these were not a secret. The Caesar photos were very much public. There's even a law named after him, the Caesar Serious Civilian Protection Act. The fact that people were being tortured to death was not a secret. It's just the world didn't pay attention. Maybe, you know, the media didn't cover it well enough. But to speak about the Assad regime, it is the worst crimes of the 21st century, par none. But now, Syria's free, no thanks to the international community, but to its own people who did it without outside help, not Turkey, not Qatar, not anyone. For now, what we're doing, what the Damascus government is doing, is trying all the best we can to secure the site, not touch anything, until we get these experts that can get in there and help.
So is the current goal to preserve the site for forensic examination?
Well, yeah, of course, and in different horrible never again moments, whether it's the Holocaust or something else. These places are sacred. They need to be preserved and honored as a message to humanity to not allow these horrific genocidal crimes to happen again. Number two, so many families, including my own, like my uncle, could be in that mass grave. My friends could be in that mass grave. We want to be able to have the right teams with the DNA portable rapid testing to come into Syria and have professionals do this, because we don't want just random people or families or organizations. You know, we can't do it ourselves. We have, you know, this is something that needs to be left to people who know how to deal with it.
Muaz, I mean, as you talk, I can't imagine what it's like to be working on this. Have you even had a chance yet to process what you've seen?
I haven't had a chance to process anything over the last 2 weeks. It has been so traumatizing to see this and to imagine what these people went through. It is horrific evil that has happened in Syria, while the world turned a complete blind eye. As a matter of fact, a lot of the world was thinking about normalizing with the Assad regime, with Bashar al-Assad, literally like the Hitler of our day.
Muaz Mustafa is the executive director of the Syrian Emergency Task Force. He spoke with us today from Washington, D.C. The Justice Department announced the arrest of two suspects yesterday in connection to a drone attack on U.S. troops last winter.
Approximately 11 months ago, on January 28th, 2024, in the northeast corner of Jordan on the Syrian border, a United States military base known as Tower 22 was subject to a deadly drone attack.
That's U.S. Attorney Joshua Levy speaking yesterday in Boston. He's the top federal prosecutor in the state of Massachusetts.
The results were devastating. Three American soldiers lost their lives. 47 American soldiers were injured, some of them quite seriously.
U.S. officials blame that incident on an Iran-backed militia, and now they're charging two men for being directly involved. Levy said that Mahdi Sadeghi was arrested in Massachusetts and Mohammed Abedini was arrested in Italy. The two men are being charged with conspiring to export sensitive technology from the U.S. to Iran, allegedly used in that drone attack in Jordan.
We often cite hypothetical risk when we talk about the dangers of American technologies getting into dangerous hands. Unfortunately, in this situation, we are not speculating.
Prosecutors say one of the accused, Sadeghi, worked at a Massachusetts-based semiconductor company, and that Abedini ran a Tehran-based technology company and has close ties to the Iranian government. Following the attack in January, the U.S. launched counterstrikes against dozens of sites in Iraq and Syria, said to be used by Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps and Iranian-backed militias. Some call it the evolution of music. Others, nah, it's straight-up stealing. The accusations from Brazil and Turkey against a song by Adele. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World.
Hi, I'm Patrick Nguyen, The World's correspondent in Bangkok. And wow, what a year. I've reported on North Korean hackers infiltrating American hospitals and military bases, continued violence against the Rohingya in Myanmar, and get this, an island called Bougainville that may soon be the next newest country on Earth. These stories are about real people facing extraordinary challenges, and they're not getting nearly enough attention. At The World, we believe in journalism that goes beyond the surface to show the human side of global events. And we're connecting the dots, showing you how decisions in Washington can have a big effect on events here in Southeast Asia, and vice versa, so you can see the bigger picture. In-depth reporting isn't easy. We can't do it without our listeners' support. As a nonprofit newsroom, we depend on listeners like you to help fund our work. Your donations pay for travel, measures to keep us safe in the field, and everything else me and my colleagues need to bring stories to life. We're quickly nearing the end of the year and our fundraising drive, and right now we have a great opportunity. A generous donor has pledged to match every donation one-to-one until December 31st, so your gift would go twice as far. If you value thoughtful, independent journalism that puts real people at the center of every story, please consider making a donation today. No amount is too small. Every dollar makes a difference. Please visit theworld.org/give to make a gift. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks so much.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The education sector in Canada hit a milestone last year. For the first time, the country hosted more than a million international students. This year, though, Canadian colleges and universities have been hit with a lot of policy changes, and the numbers of students coming from abroad is falling. From Toronto, The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
Canada reached that milestone of 1 million international students after a decade of investments.
We'd seen growth somewhere in the range of 170 to 180% increase in those 10 years.
Larissa Bizzo is the president and CEO of the Canadian Bureau for International Education. She says students choose Canada because it's seen as a safe and generally non-discriminatory place to study. The schools are also impressive. Plus,
we do have post-study work rights in Canada that are available to students,
so people can stick around after graduating. But the federal government is among those saying that international students have contributed to a strain on housing and healthcare services. Mark Miller, Canada's Minister of Immigration, Refugees and Citizenship, addressed the issue at a press conference last January.
It would be a disservice to welcome international students in Canada knowing not all of them are getting the resources they need to succeed in Canada, and having them return home disillusioned and disappointed in Canada's education system.
Miller announced a new cap on the number of international students allowed to come to Canada. The cut was significant. The government wanted to see a 35% drop from 2023's approved study permits. So far, it's been effective. From January to August of this year, Canada saw a 38% decrease in international students. Then in September...
Today, we are announcing further measures, specifically, importantly, with respect to international students.
Student permits were cut another 10%, and the country's post-graduation work permit program was adjusted to, quote, better align with immigration goals and economic objectives. For instance, college graduates and students from other non-university programs must work in specific markets, which mostly include STEM and agricultural jobs. Larissa Bizzo says all these changes have thrown the sector into a period of upheaval.
It's been a pretty substantive year in terms of changes. And so a lot of adjustment, a lot of recalibration, and a lot of kind of trying to make sense of what it all means.
Many people have criticized the Canadian government for not being clear enough about the new policies, including Maynaz Lamia, who in 2019 came to Toronto from Bangladesh to study at the Ontario College of Art and Design University.
When I tutor students, and a lot of them being international students, the question I often get asked, like, so what's happening with immigration, or can I stay? What does my future look like?
Having graduated last year, Lamia is now the international student representative for the Canadian Federation of Students. She says she doesn't have perfect answers for current students and also feels the need to brace herself for more possible restrictions.
I feel like as international students, we always live in fear that when is the next policy change going to take place? It's a very hard thing to live, like you don't know what tomorrow holds.
International students around the world are watching this news and changing their plans accordingly. Larissa Bizzo says there's been a chilling effect, and a big chunk of students aren't even applying.
The sad part about all of this is we still have lots of room for students. There's still a very strong desire on the part of our communities and our institutions to host those students.
That's the case at the University of Toronto. Vice President International Joseph Wong says the university has so far been relatively unscathed.
Our ability to attract international students this current year, 24-25, has remained really robust. We were just about 300 less than where we were last year.
Still, he too worries about the reputational damage that this year's abrupt measures will have on Canada's brand, particularly in India, a major source of international students for Canada, where Wong says the University of Toronto has seen the biggest drop in enrollment.
We've had to do a lot of correcting of misinformation, and so the president has spent some time in India. We obviously have a whole team of recruiters spending time in India to assure families there that Indian students remain very welcome here in Canada.
As a turbulent year wraps up, leaders in Canada's higher education are hoping there won't be any more cuts in the coming months and that 2025 will be a more stable year for the industry. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier, Toronto.
Here's a musical question. When two songs sound alike, who gets to claim the credit?
Já tive mulheres de todas as cores, de várias idades, de muitos amores, com umas até certo tempo fiquei, para outras apenas.
This track from Brazilian composer Toninho Gerais was first recorded in 1995. Since then, Mulheres has been considered a bossa nova classic. Now, here's another song.
Aramakmış oysa sevmek, özlememiş.
Sound familiar? Well, this one was recorded by a Kurdish songwriter, Ahmet Kaya, 10 years before in 1985. The title, Acılara Tutunmak, means clinging in pain. So what do these two songs have in common? They are both being compared to this 2015 mega hit by Adele.
I only wanted to have fun. Learning to fly, learning to run. I let my...
The Brazilian composer has been trying to strike a deal with Adele's company for years, sharing royalties and a writing credit. This week, his claim of copyright infringement was supported by a judge in Brazil. If the judgment is enforced, playback of Adele's A Million Years Ago will be subject to a fine. $8,000 whenever and wherever Adele's song is played. The verdict could be challenged, though. After all, there are many examples of tunes with the same chords and melody. That's the theme from the TV show MASH. It was everywhere in the 1970s, but it also has the same classic chord progression as those other songs I just mentioned. Makes you wonder whether any pop song can claim to be truly original. Ed Sheeran was accused of stealing Marvin Gaye's Let's Get It On. He defended himself in court last year and explained his defense to Howard Stern.
So my one is, when your legs don't work like they used to before. And then there's, have I told you lately that I loved you? And then, people get ready. There's a train coming.
So the Ed Sheeran defense goes something like this. A good melody can be expressed in any number of ways.
You just can't copyright a chord sequence. You just can't.
For now, Adele's A Million Years Ago can still be found on the big streaming services. For comparison's sake, or maybe it's just making things more confusing, one enterprising Brazilian producer has done a mashup of Adele's song and his bossa nova challenger.
I only wanted to have fun. Learning to fly, learning to run. I let my heart decide the way when I was young.
Já tive mulheres do tipo atrevida, do tipo acanhada, do tipo vivida, casada carente, solteira feliz. Já tive donzela e até meretriz.
I'm the only one who regrets the things they've done. Dueling tunes there from Adele and Toninho Gerais. Actually, kind of like this version. More global news for you still ahead this hour. You're listening to The World. The ancient Catholic tradition of preserving holy relics is about honoring the saints with physical remains connected to them.
Normally, you get these teeny little bits of bone or cloth or whatever it is. It's usually almost like a speck, but in this case, this is quite large.
We'll hear about a new Catholic reliquary in New York. That story's ahead here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. 10 years ago today, the White House revealed that it had struck a secret deal with a so-called rogue state.
Today, the United States of America is changing its relationship with the people of Cuba.
That's President Barack Obama in 2014 announcing that his administration had brokered a back-channel accord to normalize U.S. relations with Cuba. President Raul Castro simultaneously shared the news with an announcement on Cuban television.
Un diálogo respetuoso.
Castro called the newly established dialogue with Washington respectful and grounded in national sovereignty. In the months that followed, the deal opened the way for a dramatic shift in policy between two longtime adversaries. Havana and Washington reopened their respective embassies. The two governments normalized travel and expanded trade, only to have incoming President Donald Trump abruptly roll back these changes in 2017.
Effective immediately, I am canceling the last administration's completely one-sided deal with Cuba.
Today, relations between Havana and Washington are not great. Cuba's economy is in shambles. 10 years after that brief ill-fated thaw, we wanted to revisit how it came about and why it ultimately collapsed. So we reached out to the two Americans who secretly brokered the deal. Ricardo Zuniga was the Senior Director for Western Hemisphere Affairs at the National Security Council. Ben Rhodes was the Deputy National Security Advisor. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Thank you, Marco.
I can't imagine how you managed to keep a project like this under wraps for 18 months while you hammered out the details. Ben, take us back to the start. How did this get off the ground?
We reached out kind of quietly and established a channel that was me and Ricardo on the American side and Alejandro Castro, who was Raul Castro's son, Fidel Castro's nephew, leading a Cuban delegation. And we reached out to the Canadian government. They were essentially the principal host. And so we would generally fly to Canada, get whisked away from the airport by Canadian security guys, taken to a pretty remote diplomatic facility by a lake, and just sit there for many, many hours with the Cubans, trying to see how much we could transform this relationship.
Ricardo Zuniga, what were some of your sharpest memories of working through this back channel?
It is something that's a hard secret to keep. So what I remember was working this really after hours when the rest of the team had gone off or doing some other work.
Just personally and briefly, what motivated you to make this happen?
I lived there for 2 years working with human rights activists and others, and I have enormous respect for the Cuban people, and I wanted to see them prosper and do well and just be a part of the region the way they should be.
So normalization then really accelerated after the deal was struck. The State Department removed Cuba from the list of state sponsors of international terrorism. Embassies reopened. Tourism picked up. There was this exuberance in Cuba during those 2 years of this reengagement. At scene one, for example. President Obama and Michelle and their daughters visited in March of 2016, took in a baseball game. Then a few days later, scene two. Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones gave a free concert in Havana. Ricardo Zuniga, what was accomplished in those 2 years of the thaw? How much did it really advance U.S. interests and those of the Cuban people while it lasted?
People felt like they could travel more easily. They felt like they could connect with Americans more easily. They felt like they had much more communication with the outside world. I remember the moment that really struck me was watching on TV local news in Miami reporting on the first time travel of a woman who was in her late 80s to visit a home that she had left decades before and how she felt she could do that because of this change that President Obama enacted.
Well, we know how the story turned out. President Trump came into office in 2017 and shut these Obama-era initiatives down. And when President Biden took office in 2021, he did not restore the same kind of positive engagement with Cuba he'd promised on the campaign trail. Ben Rhodes, why did Biden not reengage?
First, I just want to echo something about the 2 years, because things were getting better. The travel that Americans were doing down there was pumping money into the hands of ordinary Cubans. That was making the lives of the Cuban people better. Now, Donald Trump comes in and kind of slams the door on that and reimposes sanctions. People always ask us, how did things get better? Well, how did things get better since Trump made that announcement? They have not. It's been a complete catastrophe. Cuba is currently facing an acute humanitarian crisis because of American sanctions. And sure, the Cuban government's mismanagement contributes to it. But if you just compare what Cuba was like in 2016 to what it is like today, it is dire straits. This policy is not bringing about freedom. It's not doing anything to help Cubans. It's pushing the Cubans into the arms of the Chinese and the Russians. And Joe Biden's decision to continue Trump's rollback, to me, I found even more upsetting than Trump's rollback, because, you know, I wasn't surprised that Donald Trump wants to come in and do the opposite of Barack Obama. I think Joe Biden just frankly did not have the political courage to take on a couple of well-placed senators who are hardliners on Cuba, including Bob Menendez, who was the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee at the beginning of the Biden administration. He's now been prosecuted for corruption. Right. And so I think he just, you know, on his list of things to do, he didn't want to expend political capital on this. But the reality is, because of that, 4 years after he took office, we've seen an extraordinary migration of Cubans. It's contributed to pressure at our border, fleeing just desperate circumstances. And I think it's a real stain on American foreign policy that we continue to have this policy towards Cuba that we don't have towards any other country in the world.
Ricardo Zuniga, would you agree with that?
I'll say this. There were hardliners on the U.S. side. There were hardliners on the Cuban side that have been alluded to as well. And they have not helped one bit, because they did not take full advantage of the window. And then secondarily, they're not showing a way forward. They don't have a plan or a path forward. And I think President Obama made the right decision in saying, look, we're not going to charm an authoritarian government into changing. And we're not going to, we obviously haven't managed to squeeze them into changing. So alter their circumstances.
Biden not only didn't reengage, he also left Cuba on the list of state sponsors of terrorism, even though Secretary of State Antony Blinken admitted publicly that Cuba did not belong there. Why not at least move to take Cuba off the list?
That's the most baffling, because Cuba is not a state sponsor of terrorism. Nobody can explain, you know, when we consider the international terrorism picture, nobody thinks, you know, Cuba is the source of any of it. We did a thorough review of their presence on that list, and they were removed on the merits. Donald Trump did not add Cuba to the list until the dying days of his administration. They rushed this in, I think, January of 2021. Out the door, they just stick them on this list without any process or real explanation of why. And that is the most punishing sanction, because that essentially treats anybody that does business in Cuba as if they're supporting terrorism. It's had a huge impact on the Cuban people. The Biden administration knows that the process by which Trump put them back on the list was not the normal process. It was wrong. And that there's no substantive reason to be there. I'll just name the awkward reality that there's no ideological reason for it. I don't think that Joe Biden's administration sits around and has it out for the Cubans in the way that some other players do. It's just pure political cowardice, to be blunt, because they know it'd be controversial.
Ben Rhodes, Ricardo Zuniga, looking back, are there steps you could have taken that might have made the rapprochement less reversible?
The one thing we could have done is to legislate it. But look, I mean, at the end of the day, we've seen, you know, Congress is relatively dysfunctional on a lot of things, and therefore a lot of policy in both administrations, Republican and Democrat, gets made by the executive branch, and that's the most easily reversible. But Ricardo, you may have other thoughts.
No, that's, I completely agree. I mean, foreign policy, it rests in the hands of the president for the most part. And the truth is, in the case of Cuba, with so many accumulated sanctions and policy decisions, it would take acts of Congress to really, truly reverse the relationship.
Ricardo, looking ahead, President-elect Trump has nominated Senator Marco Rubio for Secretary of State. What do you expect his appointment could mean for U.S.-Cuban relations?
Certainly the policy will remain quite strong against the Cuban government. That won't change and may even, at least rhetorically, get tougher. But the country is in ashes at this stage. There is real hunger. It's hard to make the conditions worse, even through sanctions. The question is, how do you deal with the practical reality of basically a broken society 90 miles off the U.S. coast?
Ben Rhodes, ultimately, the thaw that you and Ricardo engineered came to naught. But could this brief historic rapprochement provide a kind of model or blueprint for diplomats down the line? What's your takeaway on that?
I think so. I mean, the two things I take away are, first of all, this is going to happen again at some point. Either that or you're just going to try to break this country into a failed state, which is not a good outcome either. So I think there is a lesson that I take is that if you can kind of put a complicated history aside, identify areas of common space and common ground, and build from that foundation, you know, you can turn the page on things like this. It was political choices that led the U.S. and Cuba to be at odds. It was political choices that were getting us out of that hole, and it was political choices that put us back into it. And there's no reason we couldn't resume that work. The other thing that I take away from it on a positive side is a lot of people in those 2 years made new connections, had new experiences. A lot of Americans went to Cuba and have remained interested and engaged. And those ultimately are the people that I'd like to see determining this relationship. I take actually a very traditionally conservative view. Get governments out of the way and let these people make connections.
Ricardo Zuniga, what's your takeaway?
So my takeaway is that this really is about the Cuban people. They deserve democracy. They deserve human rights. They deserved better lives. They deserve normality. It is an amazing society with a rich history, very closely connected to the United States and our own history. And I want to see them flourish.
That's Ricardo Zuniga and Ben Rhodes. They worked on national security during the Obama administration. They've been telling us about their secret talks with the Cubans that led to a brief normalization of relations, a deal that was announced 10 years ago today. One of the oldest institutions in Britain is facing some big changes. The Royal Mail, the UK's postal service, will be sold to Czech billionaire Daniel Kretinsky. The Royal Mail was privatized back in 2013, but Kretinsky's EP Group will be the first foreign owner. That deal was approved yesterday by the UK government, with Business Secretary Jonathan Reynolds calling it the fresh start that we need. The Royal Mail has struggled in recent years to adapt to a new reality. The number of people actually using the postal service is in serious decline. When it began way back in the 1500s under King Henry VIII, the Royal Mail just served the British monarch. The public started getting mail in the 1600s. A panel of French judges will deliver verdicts this week for 51 men accused of rape and sexual assault. Over a period of several years, the men allegedly assaulted Gisèle Pelicot while she was unconscious, having been drugged by her husband. Pelicot, who's now 72, waived her right to anonymity so that the men would be tried in public. She has since become a feminist icon in France. The case has sparked a wide debate about attitudes towards sexual assault within French society. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has more.
Every day during the trial, as Gisèle Pelicot left the courthouse in Avignon, dozens of onlookers would line up outside and start to clap. Blondine Deverlange was usually among them.
We had to be here to support Gisèle, to show her and to show all the women who have been raped that women have to organize together to fight rape culture.
Deverlange, who spoke to France 24, is part of a feminist collective called the Amazons of Avignon. Every few days, women from the group printed out the words that the men accused of raping Pelicot had said in court that day and pasted them in large black letters on the wall nearby.
For example, I was not aware, or it was not my fault, or I was not here, it was my body but not my brain.
The 51 men on trial have been labelled Monsieur Tout Le Monde, or Mr. Everyman in France. They are firefighters and lorry drivers, soldiers, there's a journalist, a security guard and a DJ. Many are married with children, some have grandchildren. And the majority has denied raping Gisèle Pelicot. During the trial, there were marches in roughly 30 cities across France in support of Pelicot and against sexual violence. Women held up signs that read, "One rape every 6 minutes." There were some men at those marches, but not many. Karim Rizouli, a well-known French journalist, is one of a handful of men who have spoken out in the last few weeks. This is perhaps the first major trial of masculinity, he says, in a post on Instagram. The 50 men, the alleged rapists, are men just like you and me, he says. French activist Elsa Labaret says more men need to follow Rizouli's lead.
Men need to realise that the patriarchy is their problem and they need to fix it. They need to, you know,
retrousser leurs manches, as we say in French, get their hands dirty a little bit.
Labouret is a spokesperson for the group Osez le Féminisme, which roughly translates as dare to be feminist. Attitudes need to change, she says, and so does the French justice system.
We can't, in good conscience, recommend a victim presses charges, because we will tell her, you will suffer. This will be very hard to get justice, if at all.
Less than 1% of rape cases in France lead to sentencing, Labouret says. Those working in the justice system and the police need far more training around how to deal with victims of sexual abuse, she says. In the past few weeks, there's been a big debate in France about including the issue of consent in the law regarding rape. 14 EU countries have a yes means yes law in place, which means there must be clear consent to any sexual contact. Labouret says she's not convinced it'll make much of a difference. French lawyer Rachel Flore Pardot disagrees.
But I do support it because it might send a signal throughout society as to what is rape, a sexual intercourse without consent.
Pardot says what's maybe more important, though, is the issue Gisèle Pelicot herself brought up time and again during the trial.
Saying to victims of sexual violence, you do not have to be ashamed. There is nothing you have to be ashamed of. The shame should be on the one who assaulted you.
Pardot, who specialises in cases of sexual harassment, says she hopes the trial will encourage victims of sexual assault to speak up sooner.
The more time you wait, the less evidence there will be, and the less chance of having the ones who assaulted you being convicted.
In France, two-thirds of rapes occur in private homes, according to the National Consultative Commission on Human Rights. Dominique Pelicot, Gisèle's husband, is accused of systematically drugging his wife and then inviting dozens of men into their home to rape her while she slept. The government is now planning to introduce drug testing kits in some pharmacies to make it easier for people to check if they have been drugged. Activist Elsa Labouret says the Pelicot case should serve as a wake-up call to healthcare professionals.
Gisèle Pelicot was in bad health for 10 years. Due to the intense medication that her husband was giving her, no one saw anything. Not a single doctor or medical professional she went to thought that this was a possibility. But that is a reality. The place where women are most in danger is the home.
Outside the courthouse last month, Gisèle Pelicot made a brief statement.
Ce combat que je dédie à toutes les personnes, femmes et hommes,
I dedicate this fight to all the people, men and women, throughout the world who are victims of sexual violence, she said. I want to say to you, look around you today. You are not alone. The court in Avignon is expected to deliver its verdict on Thursday. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Still ahead this hour, a new high-speed train service from Paris to Berlin. We're just living vicariously over here. You're listening to The World. The De La Salle Brothers, also known as the Brothers of Christian Schools, is a Catholic order made up of men who dedicate their lives to religious education. The tradition goes back hundreds of years. It started in France. Today, its headquarters are in Rome. But when it comes to the most sacred holy objects for members of the order, they're found right here in the United States. John Kalish brings us a story from New York.
In a conference room off of her cluttered New York City office, Sami Surak shows me a small brass reliquary, a container for holy relics. There's a round glass window allowing visitors like me to peek inside.
I feel really special having access to this and being able to preserve and save these materials.
Surak oversees a collection of documents and holy relics at Manhattan University's O'Malley Library, which is actually located in the Bronx. And what's inside the reliquary is a chunk of bone about the size of a gumball. It comes from the hip bone of Jean Baptiste de La Salle, who founded the Brothers of the Christian Schools in 1680. He's considered the patron saint of teachers.
Normally, you get these teeny little bits of bone or cloth or whatever it is. It's usually almost like a speck, but in this case, this is quite large.
In 1937, the remains of St. John Baptiste de La Salle were transferred from Belgium to Rome in a solemn procession that drew huge crowds. The remains were taken to the order's new world headquarters, built by Benito Mussolini.
In every town, people were out on the streets celebrating his bones going by.
Surek says the provenance of St. John Baptiste de La Salle's bones is solidly documented, which is not the case, she says, with other relics in the collection. I follow Surek down to the basement where part of the archive is stored. She opens a box with colorful garments inside, gold fabrics covered with red, white, and green embroidery.
These are priest vestments that you use during the Mass.
The contents of the next box she opens are covered in tissue. She pulls out a piece of paper with a color illustration of seven De La Salle Christian brothers, five small circular objects that could easily be mistaken for jewelry are stuck to the page.
These are thecas, which are basically little amulets or little lockets, which are then displayed in a reliquary, or in some cases, they're worn.
What's inside them?
Little pieces of bone. And these are some Christian brothers who were martyred during the Spanish Civil War.
Manhattan University is a LaSallian school rooted in the legacy of this lay Catholic order. At its peak in 1965, there were 16,000 brothers serving in 80 countries. But today, there are less than 3,000 brothers in the order. As its ranks diminished, the order's schools and orphanages have been closing. That, in turn, is what prompted the transfer of documents and objects to this archive. Currently, 23 brothers are still connected to this campus, though many are retired. Brother Robert Berger is a professor of religious studies here. He says that venerating holy relics serves a purpose for religious Catholics.
Some people need reminders of people who have gone before us, whether they're saints or their relatives. You know, there's always a sense of wholeness when people connect to the past. And I think that's what relics do for us. And then there are miraculous stories about people touching relics of the saints and being cured.
He calls this the spirituality of another age.
I believe it, and yet I just can't explain it.
Archivist Amy Surek says she'd like to see the holy relics at Manhattan University displayed in a reliquary with a kneeler in front of it so worshipers can venerate the relics in the campus chapel. She says she'd like to rotate new relics into the display every few months. For The World, I'm John Kalish.
We have photos of those relics for you. Just head over to our website, theworld.org. For train enthusiasts in Europe, it is a beautiful thing. The first ever direct high-speed train from Berlin to Paris, it made its maiden voyage on Monday. Jean-Pierre Farandou is CEO of France's state-run rail operator, SNCF. They partnered with Germany's Deutsche Bahn on the project.
Deutsche Bahn and SNCF have decided to develop an international relationship between France and Germany. We are very successful in it, and we decided to launch this day relation between Paris and Berlin. It's the first time there will be a day train between our two capitals.
This train is fast, but not exactly lightning fast. Before the new line opened up, the quickest trip by rail between Berlin and Paris was about 9 hours with one connection. The new service is about an hour faster, and it's direct. For reference, that's about half as fast as the bullet trains in China. The flight between Berlin and Paris is just 2 hours. Before boarding, though, Danish travelers Simone Kirk and Nina Winter said the attraction is about something else altogether.
Well, I just think it's really expensive, so it costs us way more to take the train back home than it would have been to go with flight.
Almost double price.
Yeah. But we are willing to invest in this longer traveling and more expensive to be more climate friendly.
Investing you can also in the future.
To invest in the future, she says, and that's something experts agree with. High-speed rail is far more environmentally friendly than air travel, with estimates putting the reduction in CO2 emissions as high as 80%. French and German transportation officials are hopeful that the convenience of not having to schlep to the airport and haul luggage through security will help convince travelers to choose his greener alternative. Daily service on the new direct Berlin-Paris train is now up and running in both directions. Next time on the show, in recent years, more and more countries have been closing their borders to migrants. Thailand, though, is bucking the trend by creating a path to citizenship for almost 500,000 migrants living there.
It's so bold that they can really serve as an inspiration for this region, but also on a global scale.
The people who will benefit from the policy are stateless, meaning not only do they not have legal status in Thailand, they don't have legal standing in any country. Join us tomorrow on The World when we'll learn why Thailand is making the change and who will benefit. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org and subscribe on your favorite podcast player so you never miss a beat. I'm Marco Werman. As always, thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.